Cause no one can deny this love I have inside. I'll give it all to you, my love.
My love, my love,
my endless love.
Linoleum knife.
Happy Valentine's
Day,
everyone.
Happy falsetto singing from me.
Hopefully we didn't blow out your speakers with that.
I think we may have done that. Mm. Sorry. Yeah, so, you know, the process of finding a new tape player has taken so many little twists and turns.
Before we get to those twists and turns, let's remind everyone that this is a podcast of the cinema.
Linoleum Knife is the name. I'm Dave White. I'm the film critic of Movies.com.
And I'm Alonzo Duraldi, film critic for What the Flick and TheRap.com.
So, I still don't have... Like, I was going to go to the pawn shop yesterday. Mm-hmm. But then, I wound up at the hardware store.
You were going to sell your hair to buy me a watch
for I them. Was. And, but I, it turned out that there's not enough hair on the top of my head to sell to the wig people to get you the watch fob. Mm-hmm.
Also, I don't own a watch.
And I went to the hardware store, and I wound up getting a whole bunch of things. And it took a very long time. And I wound up paying $66.66.
You went to the hardware store of the devil.
For my items. And I just felt like that was like the perfect amount of money to spend on a thing. Exactly
two-thirds of $100.
I needed to get home and do the projects. Like, I realized I was running out of time, and I had a chair to wood glue, and I had another one that I had to bolt back into position so that people could sit on it. Because our friends are so fat.
How fat are they?
So fat. Like, okay, that's not true.
When they sit around the house.
We have a lot of skinny friends, too. But yes. When they are there, when our skinny friends are over.
They don't damage furniture.
They don't damage furniture. But our fatty friends just break things left and right. So then I had to scrape the... I'm painting the bathroom today with Gary Cotti, who's probably going to show up as we podcast. Mm-hmm. There were too many things in my head. Like... Sometimes, no, not all, sometimes, every time, all day, every day, my head is filled with a to-do list and an approximate timetable of the things that need to happen. Now, often those to-do lists wind up becoming real to-do lists in my at a glance.
You are Sarah Jessica Parker in How Does She Do It?
Then...
A movie that no one remembers.
I have to play. I have to get all these things accomplished, but then along the way, some things just go by the wayside. There's no tape player yet.
No.
There will be. It's just, I'm very busy. We're very busy.
Yes.
It will happen. We're just extremely busy.
We will get the Radio Raheem boombox if it's the last thing we do.
Yes. Until then... we just sang a love the love duet of the ages.
Yes,
for you, and I think you're welcome. That we did that,
America.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And all the ships at sea.
We are great at singing. Plus, we're a real married couple who sing endless love to each other. Fills your heart with warm emotions, doesn't it? It does.
Or cream of wheat, something.
It fills your heart with warm emotions.
Yes, yes, your warm emotions.
Also your heart. You personally, mm-hmm. Alonzo Duraldi.
Yes.
Fills your heart with warm emotions.
Yeah.
To sing Endless Love with me.
Uh-huh.
Endless Love.
Hashtag Endless Love.
Let's talk about Endless Love, the movie.
Sure, why not?
It's garbage.
Oh my God. I thought it was merely going to be a lame remake, but no, it's a lame movie that has almost nothing to do with the movie that came before it or the novel on which both films are supposedly based.
But it has a lot to do with the song.
Mm, yeah.
Because the song...
Because the song had nothing to do with the original movie.
The song from the 1981 movie had nothing to do with the film.
Yeah.
That film is crazy.
Yeah.
It's full of people behaving crazily and creepily.
Yes.
And violently. And mental illnessly.
Mm-hmm.
And
Tom Cruise telling you to set things on fire.
You know what you do? You know, gentlemen, would you like to win your lady's heart? Go to her house. Set it on fire. Then, just in the nick of time, you rescue her. She'll be so grateful, she will be your endless love.
However, if, like the guy in the book and the first movie, you time it wrong, the house burns down and everyone gets mad at you and you get institutionalized. Not in this new version, no, however.
Not in this new version. In this new version, there's only her in his life, the only thing that's right. She's every breath that he takes. She's every step he makes. And he wants to share all his love with her. No one else will do.
And her eyes.
Her eyes.
Her eyes. Her eyes. They show him how much she cares. Cares. Yes, okay, I get you.
She will always be.
She will always be.
His endless love. Boy gets girl. Boy keeps getting girl. Boy never stops getting girl. There are a few obstacles in the way.
She's rich.
None of them are super important.
She's rich. He's poor. Her dad is Mary Tyler Moore from Ordinary People.
Pretty much. He's not into it. He is not feeling this relationship.
Yes.
But his father is, his mechanic working class dad, yes. Played by Robert Patrick.
Played by the T-2000.
T-2000. He is into the relationship.
Yes.
And Jolie Richardson, who plays her mother, she's really into the relationship.
She's basically throwing her panties at this relationship.
In the original film, the mother was also really into the relationship to the point where she watched them get down.
And years later, tried to hit on him.
Hit on him, too. Like, things got real...
Squicky
in that first film. But this one is a PG-13 and it's full of innocence. And nice, Jolie Richardson walks around during the entire film saying, "Your love inspires me. It inspires me.
You're so full of light.
You're so full of light." And because he's a working class kid, he has no plans to go to college. But Jolie Richardson used to work at UGA, which is...
This movie's set in Atlanta.
Set in Atlanta, because all the movies are set in Atlanta now. Yes. Because Georgia gives some sweet-ass tax breaks to everybody who comes and films there.
It used to be,
I think a lifetime supply of peach jam as well.
It used to be exciting for me when a movie would be shot in Atlanta since I grew up there. And now all I can think about is, well, there's more L.A. jobs lost.
Right. And so...
what about all of our local gaffers and key grips? What are they supposed to do?
They go to Atlanta is what they do.
I guess is what they do.
Yeah. So, she used to work for UGA, and so she gets this big idea in her head after her daughter and Alex Pettifer have been a couple for 2 weeks. But, you know, 2 weeks, that's plenty of time for no one to deny this love you have inside.
Because, you know, the girl played by Gabriella Wilde, she was Sue Snell in the Carrie remake that you probably didn't see, and is apparently like the fourth Duchess of Grenulf or something.
She is. It's crazy. Go to her Wikipedia page and look at her complete long, crazy title and name. She's essentially a British, she's from the British aristocracy of olden times.
She's the Grand Duchy of Fenwick or whatever.
She is actually like a thing over there in England. Nobody knew this, I don't think, about her because the modern aristocrats, they hide.
Well, you know who else is? Christopher Guest.
Is he really?
He is Anthony Hayden Guest's brother.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And they're like aristos too.
That's hilarious.
Yes.
So she
spent all of high school sort of sheltered and hanging out with her parents because she had a brother who died and like the family was all ordinary people about it. And so it's not until like on the day of their high school graduation that Alex Pettifer finally like gets the stones to go talk to her. And they are by that night like making out in the closet.
Right. So 2 weeks go by and mom's like, you know, you should go to college and I'll write you a recommendation letter. And then you hear Jolie Richardson narrating the recommendation letter over the soundtrack. And seriously, this is a recommendation letter where someone says about the kid who needs to go to college, he's so full of light and love. He's transformed our family. He's given my daughter, what, like new
multiple orgasms?
Yeah, plus some, super O's. And then even says something like, rekindled my desire for
to write
life or life. It's nuts. Yeah. It's the most inept letter of recommendation that you have ever heard anyone ever write for anyone.
I wanted them to cut to Tina Fey in Admission crumpling it in a ball and throwing it
away. Which is the best part is that she used to work for a university.
Right.
And that this would be the letter she would write.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that he would...
She's got the insider scoop on what they want to hear.
They just really want to feel some super emotions
in
the letters.
This year, we're really looking for kids who are full of light.
Yeah. So that's just one element of this terrible movie.
Yeah, this movie doesn't understand not only how letters of recommendations work, it doesn't understand relationships, it doesn't understand airports.
The airport doesn't function properly.
Yeah, there is no, like...
The high school is weird because on the day of graduation, they go actually over to where the high school building is. Apparently the graduation is held on the school property, which is sometimes the case and sometimes not in real life. But on this... school is a huge plaque attached to the outside, to the exterior of the school, in memory of the kid who died.
Well, that's not out of
that. That is not what happens.
Okay.
They get a page in the yearbook.
Sorry, no.
The kid who dies gets a page in the yearbook. They don't get a plaque on the wall like they built the thing.
You're making me defend Endless Love on this front.
Do it.
There was a girl who died in a car accident when I was in high school, right. And she got a memorial bench that her parents donated to the school,
right.
That was like a marble, it was outside right. The high school, it had her name on it and all stuff, right. So it is not out of the question that the parents would have donated some sort of like smoking area or something outside. I'm kidding. Some sort of meditation tree like JT got on Degrassi, The Next Generation, after he got stabbed by the kid from the other high school. So I bought the plaque on the outside of the school. The memorial smoking area.
A kiosk with the football boosters in his name?
Yes, it is totally possible.
You think they would put a plaque on the school, like on the physical building itself?
It was on a wall outside.
No, it was on the school.
Mm-mm.
It's stupid. That is not what happened.
You're really
page in the yearbook.
You're looking for hay in a haystack. Okay, there's plenty of other stupid stuff in this movie. The plaque on the school is the very least.
I think it's a significant, ridiculous item.
Anyway, this movie's dumb, and there's nothing keeping these two ridiculously photogenic people apart from grumpy Bruce Greenwood giving, I think, the first bad performance I have seen him give. He's an actor I really like, but he's rotten in this. And the movie's dumb, and I didn't care, and it was couldn't get it over fast enough. And Ben Mankiewicz apparently cried like a biatch.
Why isn't he here today doing this podcast?
We should have
so that we could
make him stand and deliver.
We could make him cry again.
Yeah, go watch our What the Flick review of it this week, where he comes clean about his deep, heavy feelings about Endless Love, even he admits is not a good movie.
I liked that after they make PG-13 Love.
Yes.
She immediately begins listening to his heartbeat with the vintage stethoscope that her father gave her for her graduation.
That was hilarious.
A way to bring daddy into the lovemaking.
Uh-huh. And that it's light out and no one's in any hurry to get him out of the house.
It's not just light out. It's 5:40 a.m. and it is bright like noon in the house. I love the next thing they do is have a montage where they cavort around a library. Out in the stacks. They go for a bike ride. They do it in the woods. They go to the club and dirty dance.
Right.
They scribble, 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 whatever I tried to write there. They dance in a fountain. They take a bubble bath together. Mm-hmm. They go to a concert together.
Right. They ride in the back of a pickup truck.
They ride in the back of a pickup truck. And then she turns down her internship with a doctor.
Yeah, because because incoming college freshmen always go intern with doctors.
And her dad, when she decides she's going to spend the summer just boning Alex Pettifer, her father says, no, that internship is, and I wrote this down, your ticket to medical school.
Again, incoming college freshman.
They go to the family lake house for a couple weeks. They have a small town's supply of fireworks.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Just in the house.
In the garage. Like the professional level fireworks.
Yeah, they do that. They go to some terrible teen pool party, and she says to him, let's be young and dumb just for tonight.
What were you up until now? I do want to give a shout-out to an actor named, I think it's Dayo Okunai.
Yeah, he was fine.
He's fine. He plays the charming black sidekick, and he's the closest thing to a human being this movie has to offer.
Yeah.
Gabrielle Wilde's brother is played by Reese Wakefield, who is the guy with the jigsaw face from The Purge. The irritating preppy guy at the doorway who's in the fisheye lens telling them what they got to do or they're going to kill everyone. But he's supposed to be nice in this one, but he's got things happening that just make him always look like he should be leading the purge.
He has a sort of inverted triangle face.
Yeah.
Which makes him look evil.
Yes.
Even though he's not an unattractive young man.
No.
But he looks like he's always plotting to put a tack in your chair.
Yeah. Like, it looks like there's always a mouse hidden in his mouth.
Right. Like, there's going to be something mean that he's about to say or do to you.
Yeah.
But you know who gets to have careers like that? James Spader. And he did just fine.
But he's more traditionally handsome. He's just sort of brutalist handsome.
Right.
This guy looks like Mr. Sardonicus.
Now you're looking for A&M. he's a good looking boy, just severe looking.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Are we done with this dumb movie?
Am we? Sure. Yes. It's crap. Why don't you go see it? And tell us how much you endless loved it.
Now, if there's a movie that is terrible enough to inspire viewership this week on its account of terribleness, I'm going to go with Winter's Tale.
Winter's Tale is also not good.
Yeah, based on a novel that I have not read and never will. It is the directorial debut of screenwriter Akiva Goldsman, who is terrible.
Yeah. Okay, yes, he's terrible.
And yes, he has an Academy Award, and he's still terrible. He wrote A Beautiful Mind, which was not good. And he wrote Batman and Robin, which was very not good. And he wrote, like, The Da Vinci Code and Angels and Demons and a lot of...
Did he write The Da Vinci Code or just Angels and Demons? You'd have to look that up.
I'd have to look that up. He's written a lot...
He writes a lot of terrible
things. A lot of crap.
Yeah. And he wrote and he adapted this from the novel and directed it and produced it. So he called all the shots.
He also wrote The Da Vinci Code.
He called all the shots on this, and he called in all his favors. All these actors who've been in movies that he was a part of.
Russell Crowe and before. Jennifer Connelly showed up in this one.
And
he wrote I Am Legend, which was good.
I Want, and The Client, which was also pretty good.
Yeah, but he also wrote Practical Magic.
Well, okay. Well, he gets a pass.
Lost in Space.
He gets a pass for Practical Magic.
I, Robot.
Practical
Magic
is real good.
No, it's not. Let's not kid ourselves here. Practical Magic is a great movie when you have the flu.
It's on HBO. NyQuil says Practical Magic is dope.
Yeah, but you can't. You have to have the two together. Practical Magic, sure. Without NyQuil, forget it.
Look, some movies you need popcorn for. Some movies you need subtitles, the ability to read subtitles. Some movies you need NyQuil. Practical Magic is a NyQuil movie.
Fair enough.
I don't see the problem. There are many approaches to cinema.
Anyway, so yeah, so Kiva Goldsman wrote and directed this thing, which is...
Let's ignore him for now. Let's just talk about the ridiculousness.
It's a fantasy.
Yeah.
Which is an excuse that will only carry you so far.
Uh-huh.
It involves foundlings and miracles and demons.
What if, once upon a time, you decided to abandon your baby? And then the way you did it was...
Because you tried to come to America, but you turned around because your lungs were bad.
You broke into a thing that was a model of a toy boat. A model of a toy boat under glass.
A model ship.
You broke into it, and you put the baby in the toy boat, and then you dropped it off the side of a ship into the ocean. And then, that's a way. Because here's the thing, if you do it that way, you can think to yourself, well, you know, the kid's probably going to drown, and he'll go to be with Jesus, and then that'll be good for the kid.
Or he'll reach the shore, and he'll have a better life in America.
He'll have a better life in America, which is what happens.
So it's a win-win, really.
He gets adopted by a demon.
Well, actually, first he gets adopted by Graham Greene.
Really?
Yeah. Remember they have that one scene together? That he's the guy who found him?
Oh, yeah, you're right.
But somehow winds up with an Irish accent anyway, because it's Colin Farrell,
right.
Who's supposed to be 21, but Colin Farrell's 38, so even by 90210 standards, this is pushing it.
Right. He's the Andrea Zucker of this movie.
There you go. And then you have a demon gangster played by Russell Crowe.
Mm-hmm. Whose face erupts like a volcano.
Uh-huh.
And they're chasing Colin Farrell.
Right.
Because of we don't know why.
Right.
And Colin Farrell finds a white horse, and the horse bows down before him. And then Colin Farrell jumps on the white horse, and the white horse sprouts wings and flies away.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first 5 minutes of the film.
Yes, and this is not a TriStar picture.
And Bibbs had that same joke.
Did he?
In the middle of the movie.
Yeah.
He leaned into me, and he's like, TriStar logo.
GMTA.
Speaking of Bibbs, by the way, still no one has written to hate him.
Everybody loves Bibbs.
Why? You know, come on, you guys. Do us all a solid and tell us something about Bibbs that you hate, because he's feeling pretty neglected.
Yes.
Nobody cares enough to hate him.
Your lack of disdain is really hurting his feelings.
It is. Okay, so then he meets Lady Sybil.
Yes.
From Downton Abbey.
Mm-hmm. Dying again.
She's dying again. She's got consumption, which, by the way, is tuberculosis.
Yes. Did you not know that?
I knew it, but maybe some of the people who are listening to this podcast are stone cold dummies.
I mean, you listen to enough opera, you should know that.
What if they're dummies? It stands to reason that some of the people who listen to this show are super dumb.
I'm thinking that anyone who tunes into this program is a genius.
Not everyone. Statistically, statistically speaking, at least one or two of our listeners is dumb, and one of those in that group is the dumbest of the two. Among our listeners, one of our listeners is the dumbest.
Of all listeners.
We don't know who that is.
True, but even that person...
And if they are, they probably don't know how to write us a letter.
That person might well still know that consumption is tuberculosis.
Unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Look, if you are the dumbest of our listeners, I just taught you what...
It's not like we're Two and a Half Men where you just turn the TV on and there it is. You have to actually come find
us. I understand that, but what if a smart friend said, hey, maybe they've got a smart friend who's really trying to help them and thinks, okay, this is the greatest movie podcast of all time with these two geniuses who are...
you can't even finish this.
Hosting it and then
a straight face.
And I'm going to help my dumb friend by really pushing this podcast on. And the dumb friend is so flattered that the smart friend thinks, oh, look, he recommended that I listen to this podcast. He thinks I'm like him. We're tight bros. And then the dumb friend gets super hooked on our show. And by association, they get to think that they're smart. But mate, but in reality, they are our dumbest listener. And they don't know what consumption is.
Well, now they do.
Now you do.
Let's press on. So he falls in love with Lady Sybil, who is feverish.
She's so feverish. She walks around. By the way, everything we're telling you now at this point is a spoiler. So if you are against those,
you really want to go to Winter's Tale.
You should stop listening to this show for about the next 7 to 8 minutes while we lay it down. Because all of the things that happen from here on out in the movie are secrets that the movie doesn't want you to know at the very beginning.
There are still things in that movie that I don't even understand.
Like what?
Well, I mean, not that I don't understand them, but there's the talk of miracles.
Yes.
Is so annoying because no one ever stops to explain what the ground rules for them are.
They don't.
They just keep mentioning that one's going to happen and it's good. If it's preventable or if it's not preventable and it's,
There is a paradigm existing in the film in which everybody is responsible for a miracle.
Right.
Okay. And the demons and angels sort of battling each other in the film, they get it wrong. They get the miracles wrong. They get their miracles mixed up with the wrong people.
Right.
So they make mistakes.
Based on assumptions.
Come back to bite them in the devil butt.
Mm.
Meanwhile, the humans who are going to give each other a miracle are also don't really understand what their miracle is going to be, which leads to the plot happening. So, like, Lady Sybil has got the TB,
uh-huh.
And she's so heated up, she has to sleep essentially outside in the snow.
Yeah.
She
walks barefoot in the snow.
She walks barefoot in the snow, and it melts under her feet into puddles of slush.
Yeah.
She's apparently...
She is torrid.
She's 500 degrees, all right? And so she has to keep her temperature down.
Mm-hmm.
But then she falls for Colin Farrell. Now, I think we all understand that if you are looking to keep your temperature down, you don't give your virginity away to Colin Farrell. You have seen...
He's going to make you blow up.
You have seen his sex tape. You know what the man is capable of. His penis is 1,000 degrees. He puts that thing in you, and you can be 500 degrees and melt in the snow, and it's going to spontaneously combust you, which is what happens to Lady Sybil. He bones her to death.
Yes, he sweats gasoline.
Which is pretty great. And he didn't mean to.
No.
And she even said, as she's expiring, it pleases me.
So then he tries to save her by putting her in this bed that the younger sister had created that would bring the princess
gonna be a miracle bed.
Back to life.
That's a miracle
but
bed.
Then she doesn't
the right
work.
Miracle for her.
So then he
made a mistake thinking that was the miracle.
Then he develops amnesia and lives
the demons
for,
made a mistake in thinking that killing Lady Sybil was their miracle crushing event.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So he then develops amnesia and then lives for another 100 years
yes.
without aging.
Yes.
At which point...
Which is great, because he still gets to look like Colin Farrell.
Yeah, at which point then his memory comes back, and he winds up finding the little sister again, who is now the 107-year-old, still editor-in-chief of the newspaper, played by Eva Marie Saints.
Yes.
Which makes no sense at all. Apparently the book was set in the 80s.
So that she would be like an 87-year-old
exactly.
editor
yeah.
of a New York newspaper.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or 77.
Still unlikely, perhaps, but...
But not as ridiculous as, yeah. you know. So yeah, where this movie really chafes is where its fantasy elements and its sort of real-world grounding hit each other in a way that's completely bonkers.
But even more so than that.
And also, the only thing that's really good in it is the stuff between Colin Farrell and Jessica Brown Findlay, a.k.a. Lady Sybil. But boy, once she's out of the movie and you realize there's a whole act to go, it's
you're like, where's Lady Sybil?
Yeah, I gritted my teeth. Like, oh, God, we're going to be here for a while.
Because she's extremely beautiful.
Yeah.
And even if, you know, you're not into ladies, she's just a treat to look at. And so you
But she's not just pretty. She's,
you want to keep looking at her and enjoying her.
She's charismatic.
Her, and, her soft gentleness, which is kind of her vibe.
Right.
The bigger problem with this movie is not that it's the problem is not that it's a fantasy. The problem is that it's not bad enough. As I said in my review at movies.com, these bad films don't just spring up fully grown from the head of Zeus. You know, they're as they are, in keeping with the theme of the film, they are as miraculous as a masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
In that, in a masterpiece, all the decisions made are right and inspired and visionary. And in an anti-masterpiece, in a truly transcendent, sort of psychedelically bad film.
Like, say, The Apple.
Which, by the way,
you can order our commentary track
for $1.99. And you should.
Absolutely.
You owe us, really. And you owe it to yourself to buy an extra episode of this podcast where we discuss one movie that we love. A monumentally bad film.
Yes.
That we discuss in detail from a lot of different angles.
Mm-hmm.
Not like a riff track, not like an MST kind of thing, but you know, as the professional film critics we are.
That's right.
Anyway, a monumentally bad film requires the same sort of perfect line of decisions, all of them wrong.
Right.
And together those congealed bad decisions,
perfect storms,
become this thing that you cannot stop looking at. You must see it, and you must see it again.
Mm-hmm.
And you must see it again. Because within that mass of bad decisions grows a mystery. The mystery of how it could have happened like that. How could this have been created in 6 days? You know? Or 6 minutes, or for $6, or whatever, you know, whatever reasons made it take place. There's an element of mystery to every truly staggeringly bad movie.
Right.
This does not have that mystery. This is someone's earnest attempt.
This is merely misguided Hollywood product.
Yeah, to be romantic.
Yeah.
And it is bad, and it is laughable, but it's not the kind of bad and laughable that you really fall in love with. You know what I mean?
No, yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's not special enough. Although my joke on What the Flick again was that, you know, I could see this inspiring a drinking game where every time someone hits the pause button and asks, "Excuse me, what?" you drink. It is just kind of. I didn't say it was a bad movie because it was a fantasy. I said what's bad about the fantasy is that it's grounded in this reality in which the fantasy then makes no sense whatsoever.
Right.
You know. This movie is just. I would say when it pops up on cable, fast forward and watch the Lady Sybil scenes and then skip the
rest. She's really good at dying young.
She is.
I can watch her die young.
And falling over in love and over with falling in love with working class Irishman.
Yeah. Whose accent is the only element of mystery in the film. He's grown up in New York and is sort of taken in by Russell Crowe as a teenager.
Yeah, after being found by Graham Greene, but neither of them are Irish.
Yeah, well, Crowe is doing a really crazy cartoony cartoony Irish accent.
What's his name in the movie? It's something crazy.
It's Pearly
Soames.
Pearly Soames.
That's it.
Yeah. Which is, you know.
I don't even know what that is.
He might as well call himself Pearly Gates. You know, the irony of his name. You know, I'm really a demon. Get it?
Yeah.
So that's not good either.
Nope.
RoboCop. We're a little divided on RoboCop.
Yeah.
I think it's better than you think it is.
I suppose. I think that for a lot of people, the bar got lowered because, A, they thought that any remake of this beloved, you know, outrageous satire was going to be, you know, a big mistake. And B, the RoboCop legacy has already been tainted by the crappy, sequels and, you know, the wasn't there a TV show or something or a cartoon?
I think, there was.
So it's
don't
not.
Don't ask me to discuss it in detail.
Yeah, really no. So the property has not been well handled over the years. No. So I think those two things have kind of made people say, well, I mean, it's okay. And there are some things that work. I'm not saying it's a wholesale disaster. But I just found it generally unengaging, and I didn't really understand. I don't see why it exists. There's a flirtation with the idea that they are going to be satirical about drones, but they don't really go anywhere with that.
The opening is great.
The opening promises. The opening writes a check that the movie refuses to cash.
Yeah.
You know, we open with like a cable news network showing us how we're using these robots to keep the peace in Iran, which I guess now we've invaded or whatever. And it's basically like robo stop and frisk, where everybody on the street is forced to like hold their hands up and get scanned, you know. Mm-hmm. And of course there are suicide bombers because they're mad, and so right. that's kind of an idea. And the, you know, then why can't we have this in the US to keep our cities clean? And so then we cut to Detroit, and they never really establish, I think they just sort of assume that we know that Detroit is terrible. Because the first movie, you know, it's New Detroit. I mean, they're giving away
houses in Detroit.
Yeah, well, no.
To people like us.
I understand. I'm just saying. The,
that's a real thing, you know.
Yeah, I know.
They're giving away houses to writers.
Yes.
To attract arts individuals to the city.
Given that nobody can afford to live in San Francisco or New York anymore, like that's a smart move.
That's not a bad idea, yeah.
But the Verhoeven movie at least gives us a few scenes of like the scum of the earth, you know, like people mugging, you know, old ladies or whatever. Uh-huh. So we get this Detroit just seems sort of, because it's the near future, I think it's like 2020. It just seems sort of blandly a city, you know, like, right. and we know that there are corrupt cops, and it's kind of the same deal as Ride Along, you know, there's a crime lord, and he's got an in with the police force, and there's a good cop trying to root him out, So Alex Murphy this time around, Joel Kinnaman, who I've never watched a killing, I've never seen him in anything, this comes off kind of bland, we don't really know much
about him. He's fine at being robotic.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, we don't know anything about this guy except that he's like a good cop and a good dad and a good husband, and that's it. And so the villains or the people conspiring, whatever, wind up being far more interesting. Gary Oldman is the scientist who creates RoboCop. Michael Keaton is the shady CEO of the company who's trying to, like, you know, implement this in the U.S. to make a lot more money. Jennifer Ely, who I adore, plays this sort of, you know, like smarmy PR flack type, and so does Jay Baruchel. But the central thing of Joel Kinnaman and his wife, Abby Cornish,
yes,
they're kind of...
Who I'm into Abby Cornish.
No, she's great.
She's cool. You should see Bright Star, Jane Campion film Bright Star.
Yeah, and she's really good in Stop Loss. She's not given anything to do here.
Right, no.
I don't know. To me, this movie kind of, it's like, yeah, it's not the... When you first heard, oh, they're making a PG-13 version of RoboCop, it's not as awful as you would have thought, but I just found it not all that interesting.
I'm going to do this twice in one broadcast, as I say in my review on movies.com.
This is actually your third now.
But is it?
Maybe.
Maybe it is. Back in the 80s, it was punk rock to like RoboCop, and the reason it was punk rock to like RoboCop was because... Verhoeven was sort of sneaking into Hollywood from behind, you know, making all these like cruel Dutch films, and then coming in and taking a genre film and sort of infusing it with his own obsessions about fascism and protest and you know.
He was making a stealth anti-Reagan
domination of
a stealth anti-Reagan movie and selling it to people who loved Ronald Reagan.
Essentially, yes. And if there's one thing you hated when in the 80s, if you were punk rock, it was Ronald Reagan.
Where's that coming from?
I don't know.
It's probably you
holding my microphone.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'll stop holding it,
please.
This movie. accepts the fact that we now live in a world where everything is just sort of ruined. and it seems fine with that. You know, it protests a bit, you know, the Sam Jackson character playing essentially Bill O'Reilly. But the movie isn't interested so much in tearing that down as it is in providing that as a comedic, you know, oh, isn't this guy ridiculous, sort of thing. It has a resigned quality to it. The satire and the protest of this film. There's no fury. No. There's no rage. There's no fire in this movie.
It's like when people talk about the NSA spying, and you just get the impression they're sort of like
what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, like, we know this is crappy, and we hate it, but this is the world we live
like
in.
How am I supposed to fix that?
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, there's a resignation.
That's the way this movie feels. Having said that, I kind of enjoyed myself because it's a good action movie. The guy from Elite Squad, Jose
Padilla.
Shannon Leolds, our wonderful friend, who was the special effects editor on this film. She taught me how to say his name the other day, and I'm still not good at saying it. He's Brazilian and Portuguese. It's an impossible language.
Yeah.
And so I've said that once before. People are going to think I'm anti-Portuguese.
I'm not even going to bring up the horrible slurs you bring up whenever a Jobim song
totally
comes on Pandora.
I'm super racist against music.
The poor Astro Gilberto does not deserve the calumny that you heap on him.
So he's great at action, you know, and this movie has a lot of cool blowing things up and violence, which I'm always down for violence. But that's kind of all it brings. I don't hate it. I sort of liked it. It's better than I figured it was going to be.
Yeah.
It's just not. It's not necessary.
No.
And it doesn't reach, I think, what it should.
And I think, I mean, the action sequences are fine. I didn't think they were particularly notable, given that that's what this guy's, like, area of expertise is. I didn't really see why it needed to exist.
Anyway, about last night.
The surprise winner of the week.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of, you know, should you care?
Yeah. If you were going to go see a new movie this week, this would probably be the one. So it is a remake of the 1986 comedy, which in turn was an adaptation of the David Mamet play,
yes,
Sexual Perversity in Chicago.
Rare.
And this new one pretty much leaves everything out of the play, yes, but does capture a similar sense of, like, fast-paced repartee, body realism about how people talk about sex with their friends.
Right.
And it's very entertaining.
And it's got Kevin Hart and Regina Hall, who are now my new favorite screen couple.
Mm.
I want them to be in everything. I want everything to be remade with an all-black cast, and I want them to be the leads, and I want them to just yell at each other for the rest of their careers. I want them to remake Bringing Up Baby. I want them to do everything together.
How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days.
Yes, they should do. They are the Johnny Cash and June Carter of hate effing. It is such a pleasure to watch them be irritable with one another and scream at each other.
Yeah.
I'm in love with her, and I have been.
Yeah,
I have been since Scary Movie. Because she's Brenda.
She's been...
I've been entranced by her since Shakespeare in Love.
She has been not used well with some frequency.
She is criminally underappreciated.
Yeah, like in the Best Man movies, she doesn't really get much to do. So as a vehicle for her and as sort of the confirmation that Kevin Hart now rules the world, you know.
I'm glad because as much as I disliked Ride Along,
mm-hmm,
he was the only thing that bounced in that movie.
Yeah.
And I think he's really funny. I even liked that stand-up movie, which was not great. But, no, I mean, he is a funny dude.
Yeah.
And he will take, I guarantee you that he and she took whatever dialogue they were supposed to do and then went off with it.
Probably so.
The
script is credited to Leslie Headland, who wrote and directed Bachelorette, which I didn't see and you hated.
I hated that movie.
And it's directed by Steve Pink, who did Hot Tub Time Machine, which I did not care for.
Hot Tub Time Machine's fine.
So, you know, this was a surprising good. Again, like the couple in Endless Love, we have Michael Ealy and Joy Bryant, who are kind of dull as the central.
They're very, very good looking.
Yes, they're very pretty, and their problems are very.
He's from Barbershop and a variety of other films.
Yeah, she's on Parenthood.
She's on Parenthood.
Yeah, yeah, Michael Ealy, he was in Think Like a Man. He's doing a lot of stuff.
Everyone's in Think Like a Man.
Yeah, exactly. And we saw the trailer for Think Like a Man, T-O-O. Not to be confused with Why Did I Get Married, T-O-O.
I'm stoked. The first Think Like a Man.
Which Regina Hall is in.
Really very funny.
Yeah, it was.
Think Like a Man is very funny.
Yeah, that was one of the reasons I was so disappointed with Ride Along, because it's Tim Story directing Kevin Hart, and it was not nearly as funny as Think Like a Man was.
Yeah.
I don't know if I told the sexual perversity story on the show. Do people know this?
You have.
Really?
You sure? Yeah. But I'll tell it for you.
Oh, fine.
Just in case no one... In case we have new listeners who don't know.
Or the stupid ones forgot.
About your... Maybe the stupidest person who listens to the show forgot this story.
Right.
Because they're too busy taking cats and swinging them around by the tail and going... when you were in college, you took a theater class. And you directed a play.
Okay, not entirely. That's
and
not.
That play... was Sexual Perversity in Chicago.
I did not direct it as part. I did not direct it as part of a class. I directed it on my own. But I had taken.
You
class.
Helmed a production. You.
The one thing I ever. The one thing I ever directed. because you're telling this all wrong. I made up a major when I went to college because
you sure did.
Because I wound up at a school that had neither a film program nor a journalism.
You made
program.
Up a major in essentially in criticism.
Yes.
No. Yeah.
But I thought part of what I should do is, if I indeed wanted to be able to review stuff from a knowledgeable point of view, I took a semester class on acting, and I took a semester class on directing.
You got your parents to pay for an education at Vanderbilt University with a major that you pulled out of your butt.
Yeah, well, I have a BA. That's all that matters. I finished. It works. I am employed.
People with money. Keep going.
Shut up. Anyway, so I took a directing class and it was fun and I liked doing it. I thought, all right, I'm gonna direct a play.
You did.
So I directed a play and so you know if anybody ever you know tries to come at me with the you know how dare you be a critic when you can't do blah blah blah, I can always say. Dude, I directed a play.
Dude, I directed a play in college.
That's right.
At my...
I wrote a hit play.
university. I wrote a hit play. Anyway, this is a pretty darn good movie.
It is, yeah.
It's very funny from start to finish.
It is like 500 Days of Summer, the sort of the new LA paradigm of we all live downtown and do everything downtown.
Yes.
And oddly enough, I went on the walking tour of the downtown theater district yesterday and boom, there it was, the Broadway Bar, which is not only a prominent location in the film, but the title of the film appears in the same font as the Broadway Bar sign.
Yes. So it's very nice. There are elements of strangeness in the movie, that weird, you know, the weirdness of everything taking place downtown, in a sort of her style, you know, future of everyone being self-contained in this little five-block area of Los Angeles.
It's movies that treat LA as though it were New York, which it is not.
and then my own personal thing of following the people eating.
Oh, yes.
In the movie, that is a weird thing as well.
You were obsessed with this.
I was obsessed with it. Well, the movie made me obsessed.
Well, yeah, that's true. Once you pointed it out, I noticed that the movie was really bad about this.
There are a good half a dozen scenes in the film of people eating.
Not eating.
And at no point in the movie does anyone eat. The film routinely has people shoving food off a table so they can do it, abandoning the meal so that they can go out.
Throwing a Thanksgiving turkey out the window.
Throwing Thanksgiving dinner out the window. Or, my favorite, eating Chinese food and not eating it. But holding the chopsticks, making the chopsticks go from the carton to the mouth with no food in the chopsticks.
I think sometimes there might be like a bean sprout
A grain of rice, perhaps, that is completely missable. But no. Empty chopsticks taken from the carton to Joy Bryant's mouth, which she then puts into her mouth, and she pretends to eat.
She's sucking on wood.
Eating air.
This is
crazy.
This is an observation.
To watch this film. This film's relationship with food.
I remember about 10 years ago or so, Dave and I were watching like Gilmore Girls or something. And
Felicity.
Felicity. Okay. It was some of those shows. And Dave suddenly out of nowhere goes, actress bites. What? Actress bites. Watch. And like
they Felicity would have, and the other girl were
they
eating.
Would have like a piece
each
of cake.
Had a Krispy Kreme donut in their hand. And what's her face? Felicity. What's her name?
Carrie Russell.
Carrie Russell takes a fingernail sized portion of donut and picks it off the donut and puts it up to her mouth and then goes and then has a line of dialogue and then takes another tiny little fingernail-sized piece of donut.
Now, I'm sure for a lot of experienced...
That's the thing.
A lot of experienced actors learn the hard way that you don't wolf while you're shooting, because what happens if you have...
You know who does?
Because what happens if you have 20 takes? And then you're barfing Burger King into a bucket. However... There are so many.
I have the bucket right next to you.
There are so many skinny.
You don't have to barf it. You just
actresses right now that you just know that they get on the set and somebody hands them the Krispy Kreme donut or whatever, and they're just like, no.
I'm gonna say it again. I've said this before. I probably even said it on this show. You be like Chloe Sevigny. you be like Chloe Sevigny. You take a big bite of waffle. And then you say your line with a full mouth of waffle.
That
line happens to be, you look like a complete whore, even better.
She did that one time on Big Love. For all we know, there were other actress bite moments.
And it will live in my memory until the day I die. And if I ever meet her in the supermarket, I'm going to put some piece of food in my mouth, and I'm going to go, you look like a complete whore.
Oh, I hope I'm there.
And she and I are going to become friends because of it.
And you were going to be tased by security. But
that's what you do. But put the food in your
seriously,
mouth.
Seriously, start paying attention during movies, during TV.
No, don't. Don't start paying attention because it will ruin.
Well, look, you did it to me. So now the ring style, I have to pass it along to others. Start looking for actress bites, and it will drive
it's
you.
It's not just actresses. It's
actor bites.
It's actors as well, yeah.
Yeah, like anytime there's a carbohydrate on the screen, just watch it how the dinky, dinky, like, they might as well be eating it with dollhouse forks.
Or the playing with the food.
Yeah,
the
or plane, moving like, it around moving without it around. Actually eating any of it. You know.
It drives me nuts.
So yeah, there's a lot of that in About Last Night. It's still worth seeing.
It's so thematically, like, it's so consistent and pure in this film that it never happens.
It's almost like the discreet charm of the bourgeoisie.
It's like you're watching the movie going, is this thematic? Like, are they denying themselves
pleasure?
Pleasure? Like, it's very, yeah. And I'm sure it was just a consistent stream of errors, but it looks great, and it's in an otherwise really funny
film.
It
is very funny. Yeah. Also very funny is
I did not see.
A movie that I saw called Date and Switch. It is
originally meant to be called
Gay Dude.
Gay Dude is
Gay
what they
Dude
were going to call it.
Shooting title.
And they changed the title.
Yeah, and it is now playing on demand. So wherever you are, you can watch it. I mean, it's on one screen on a half schedule in Los Angeles. So they're the theatrical.
They really believed in it.
Well, Yeah. I think they just that's a new sort of paradigm for this sort of thing for certain movies. So it's a high school comedy, not unlike GBF, which was my DVD recommendation last week. It's about, you know, classic setup, two best friends, they've just broken up with their girlfriends, they decide they've got to lose their virginity before prom night, but then one of the friends tells the other one, oh, by the way, I'm gay.
Right.
And the gay one is... sort of like they kind of mini Seth Rogen him in this movie. Like, yeah, he's kind of schlubby, he's kind of a slob, he's fat, in quotes.
He's movie fat. Right.
The gay one is played by Hunter Cope. The straight one is played by Nicholas Braun, who is a character, is a young actor you've seen and stuff. He was in Perks of Being a Wallflower, he was just in at Middleton. Like, you see his face, and you're like, oh yeah, that guy. And then Dakota Johnson, who is the daughter of Don Johnson and Melanie Griffith, who's about to star in 50 Shades of Grey, is in it. Really fun supporting cast. Gary Cole, Megan Mullally, Nick Offerman, Aziz Ansari, like almost everybody who was ever on The Daily Show, you know, that kind of movie. Wendy McClendon Covey all pop up. It's a funny movie. It's goofy and it's silly, and it, I think, represents this interesting sort of new paradigm of gay movies that are not grinding their teeth about the subject, and right, where the gay guy is generally speaking the more adjusted one, and it's everybody else that has to sort of deal with their crap.
Right. That's how it is in my life.
Yeah, but it's I laughed.
I'm the great one, and mm-hmm, everyone around me
has to step
needs
two.
To,
yes,
needs to learn how to behave.
Anyway, I laughed a lot. I had a good time with it, so I would definitely recommend that people check it out. Date and Switch. It is currently streaming on Amazon, and I'm sure elsewhere.
I've got a DVD recommendation.
What's that?
It is called Science is Fiction, 23 films by Jean Painlevé. He was a nature documentary filmmaker decades and decades and decades ago. And he influenced, you know, other people, surrealists. And this DVD, which is, yeah, it's available. Like, you can buy it.
It's out of print.
It's not cheap. No. It's in print, and yeah, okay, but it's just not. It's not cheap. He is going to have a little mini series of his films shown tomorrow night here in Los Angeles at
Monday night
at Red Cat. Yeah, Monday night the 17th. I'm going if I don't, unless I have to go see like Pompeii or something.
This is the bane of our existence.
Yeah.
Always cool things happening in LA. We don't get to go because we have to go see
I can't
Pompeii.
Wait. They're going to show the vampire, they're going to show the seahorse, and they're going to show the octopus in love. Now, if you want a little taste of this stuff, go to YouTube and type in his name. Painlevé, basically. Painlevé. Painlevé.
And raised they, bread?
There are... Look, that's a delicious name. You can see some of these old...
Joe Yeast.
You can see some of these little short documentary films on YouTube. Mm. I'm sure they're completely illegal, but it'll give you a taste of what it is, and you will be entranced. Like, so groovy, so much fun to watch. And honestly, I haven't seen all 23 of these on the DVD, but I want this DVD now. Like, that's...
I see.
I have to own it.
Speaking of events in LA this week, our friend Matt Seitz will be here to sign his acclaimed book about Wes Anderson on Tuesday night. And it's screening The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou at the New Beverly. And I should go ahead and be plugging this because it's an event I'm putting together for Outfest. I'm curating their new monthly series at the West Hollywood Library in the City Council Chambers. And on March 5th, we are paying tribute to the late Philip Seymour Hoffman with a retrospective screening of Capote. You can get more information about that at outfest.org. My DVD pick this week is Ondine, which is a much better romantic fantasy starring Colin Farrell than Winter's Tale.
Ondine is really good.
It is directed by Neil Jordan. It is set in the current day, in the modern day, and Colin Farrell plays a guy who is a single dad trying to get his life together and catches a woman in his net who may or may not be a mermaid. It's lovely and very sweet and charming, and he's really good in it, and people should see it.
Yes.
Letters?
Got them. Hello, Alonzo and Dave. First, thank you for continuing to be my favorite podcast. And thank you for the great guests you book.
Yay.
I, in particular, loved both Jack Morrissey and Manolo Dargis.
Well, all right.
And look forward to hearing them on future episodes. Please ask Jack if he has any dishy dream girls behind the scenes in his chair. I bet he does.
I suspect that he might, yes. Yeah.
I also want to thank Dave for his recommendation of The Process de Jeanne d'Arc. It was my first person, and I thought it was fantastic. I don't think I can watch O Hussar Baltasar because it looks like a sad animal movie, and I cannot do sad animal movies. So Alonzo does not feel left out. Please know that this agnostic Jewish girl DVRs Godspell every Easter as well and loves it.
Yay.
My question. With the question over whether Woody Allen molested his daughter back in the news,
oh boy.
Parenthetically, for the sake of honesty, I will admit that I am inclined to believe his guilt based on everything I have read. I wonder if, in your line of work, do you ever have an issue separating the art from the artist? For instance, I have only watched one Woody Allen film since the Sun Yi debacle. Midnight in Paris, which he conveniently doesn't appear in. And I will only watch Roman Polanski films from before his pre-forced sodomy on a teenage girl. But there are actors who have problematic personal lives, Sean Penn, and I am still able to watch their performances. Perhaps actors have the advantage of disappearing that is not offered to their behind-the-camera counterparts. I understand that you are most likely unable to refuse to watch the works of certain figures, but are there any actors slash writers slash directors whose real life issues have intruded on your ability to enjoy their work? Thank you for the great conversations, wit, and cinematic education. Rebecca.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Well, Rebecca.
Look, the example I always cite is Tommy Lee Jones.
Victor Salva.
Right. Well, Victor Salva, luckily, I'm not called upon to see his films. He still works, right?
It is infrequent that we have to actually review his films.
Yeah, Victor Salva, the director.
He hasn't made a big movie in a while.
No, he directed Powder and the two Jeepers Creepers movies. He is a convicted child molester.
Yeah.
He did it with an underage actor in one of his early 14-year-old boys that he cast in one of his movies.
And then went to prison. He went to prison.
He is now a registered sex offender.
He got out of prison and somehow became a successful filmmaker.
Yeah.
I don't know how that worked or what. I don't get it. But it happened, and we actually know someone who knows him.
Yes.
Who tells us from time to time, well, you know, that was his past and he paid his debt to society. And that is true. But at the same time,
it's hard not to think about it
while you're watching his films,
especially when
you have to review them.
Well, especially
given their subject matter, which they are frequently about people stalking hot young teenage boys.
Yeah, or about being special and different and better than everybody else.
Yeah, it's very weird. His movies are, I think the word is, fraught.
problematic.
With trouble.
Yeah.
But I just, you know, it on one level, though, he remains sort of an object of fascination to me because I want to know what he's going to do movie wise next.
I've not ever been assigned to review one of his films, so it hasn't come up.
Yeah.
I always go back to Tommy Lee Jones in that he was a jerk
personally
to me personally,
a jerk to you personally, to your face in your presence. Over the course of an entire evening.
Yeah, aimed at me.
Yeah.
And I still think he's a really good actor, you know?
He's amazing.
I see, No Country for Old Men. I see Hope Springs. I see Lincoln. I'm like, oh, damn it, Tommy Jones, you're good.
You're such a bastard, and yet you are so good. And it's not just you that he was mean to.
No.
He's horrible
generally awful.
Everyone.
To people. Yeah, there's stories about.
It's in print. Like, Chris O'Donnell did an interview years ago saying, no, I will never be in another film with him. Life is too short.
Yeah.
And that's, you know... So it's documented,
right?
But I remember when I saw Old Country for Old Men, No Country for Old Men, and he was so amazing in that movie.
In the Valley of Ella.
When it was over, I thought, "Well, Tommy Lee Jones, you know what? I forgive you for being horrible to my husband. You just got a pass. So, you earned your way out of my personal condemnation."
I mean, and the thing is, if you start working backwards,
but you're still a dick.
to all art ever, you know, to paintings and music and novels, you know, I mean, there's a lot of really terrible human beings who are great creators of things, you know. Charles Dickens had mistresses, you know, and I mean, you can
Walt Disney was an anti-Semite,
right? Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of things that you can dig up and apply towards people, and so obviously when
I don't want to equate mere unpleasantry
right with actual crime,
raping children, we are now in the position of thinking that perhaps Woody Allen did this, and Roman Polanski is known to have done this, and is basically admitted to have done it,
right?
And yet we still have to review Roman Polanski films and Woody Allen films, and sort of separate them out on that level, and it's not easy to do that because you look at these guys and you're like. Like part of me, I'm not even going to go down this road because, you know, if I had to pick between Roman Polanski and Woody Allen, who's more guilty given, you know, circumstances or whatever, that's just, you know, you can't do that. It's horrible. And the situation with Woody Allen and Dylan Farrow is that someone's lying and someone's telling the truth. I'm inclined to believe, personally, that you believe the kid. The kid says that happened, it happened. You know, we have friends to whom this has happened. And, you know, what if no one had believed those kids? What if no one had believed our friends when they finally spoke up and said, hey, this is happening to me? That would have been horrible. You know, you live with this terrible thing that happened to you. But here's ultimately... We're never going to know the answer.
No,
probably. We are never going to know the answer to this. We do know the answer to Roman Polanski. I think he's actually a more problematic case because he did it. He did it. And then he hot-footed it out of the country to get away from it. And yet...
Oh, but even that is... There's like weird stuff where there was the one judge who wanted to...
I know.
Who reneged on the
promise. I know. There's a whole documentary about it.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean...
So,
I think that the simple answer is ultimately I try to tune out the artist and just focus on the art.
Yeah. But as in the context of our job and our working life, we have to separate the art from the artist. If I were not doing this for a living, it would be a whole other, you know, situation that I would have to say to myself, like, am I going to pay money for this? You know, like, do I support this person financially with my, you know, couple bucks that they get from my ticket, however much they get from my ticket price?
Right.
You know, it's hard to know what you would do. You know, I listen to a lot of hip-hop artists who sure do hate some gays. And
I do not.
I never get that mixed up in my head. Like back in the day when DMX was a viable artist,
right?
That dude, everything he said was anti-gay.
Well, you know, you famously defended Eminem in The Advocate when Marshall Mathers.
Yes, I did. And so it's hard to. it's hard to draw a line. Everyone's got to draw that line for themselves.
Yeah.
And here's the thing I really don't want to happen.
What's that?
I don't want everyone to walk around calling each other complicit in stuff for making these personal choices
right.
on what kind of art they're going to bring into their life.
Wherever you draw the line is appropriate for you.
Yeah.
You know, and I understand people who are who feel that they cannot, you know, watch or listen to or read or whatever the work of artist X. I just kind of feel like ultimately, you know, 200 years from now, the films will be there.
Yeah.
And all of the participants will not.
Yeah.
And it's and history will decide whether or not that work endures.
This podcast, for example, is forever.
Endless love.
Endless love. Dear Dave and Alonso, the B-Movies podcast does a semi-regular feature where the hosts list their top 10 movies from a given year, and I always find the lists interesting, and I almost always go back and rewatch films based on them. I think assigning your listeners a particular year to create top 10 lists for would be fun, interesting, and a way to reinvigate the top 10 lists. So apparently our top
10
list...
Oh, are we boring you?
Is losing its vigor.
I see. It's growing slack.
Think of all the movies you would get to knife. Personally, I might want you to linoleumize my next list, which sounds dirty. Thanks for putting together such a fun podcast each week. Apparently, except for the top 10 lists, yes, which are losing their vigor. Yes. And thanks for seeing all the crappy movies so we don't have to. That's from Chris.
Thanks, Chris.
Also, my birthday is on April 25th, and I expect you to sing happy birthday to me during the opening minutes of the podcast.
I do not want to do anybody's birthday.
Message me on Facebook, and we might consider your request.
Yeah, if people want to send us their top 10 list of, you know, 1991 or 1968.
Or 1994.
When life is nothing but your business.
Please. Please, Ashley. This is 1994.
Knock yourself out. We'll take whatever you want.
Hello.
Hello.
Abrupt. I've been a huge fan of your podcast for several months now. Great work.
Hurrah.
After you described the Sobibor documentary, I went looking for it online, but no luck. Yeah, I know. It's hard to find. There is a full version. I know what's coming here, too. There's a full version on YouTube without English subtitles.
Oof.
The man taunts me with his opaque awesomeness. Do you have any idea where I could find a copy? I do. Do you have a copy you'd be willing to lend to a fan in exchange for something previous as collateral, precious as collateral, or baked goods? I'd make a mean chocolate chip cookie. Oh, yeah, well, so do I. Best, Ben. Well, Ben, here's what's up. You can get Sobibor if you have a Blu-ray player and you are willing to purchase the Criterion Collection Showa box set, which has all of Showa and Sobibor and A Visitor from the Living and the Karski Report.
Is it on Hulu Plus?
I don't know. Possibly. But I'll tell you, the Criterion box of Showa costs like $60. So I'm of the mind that it's worth $60 to see everything in this box set. But that's up to you. Unfortunately, I too went hunting for Sobibor before my friend Matt lent me his Criterion box.
Which we cannot loan you.
Which we cannot loan you because it belongs to him. So that's what's up. $60. We'll test your devotion to seeing Sobibor. Next letter, last letter. Saludos to my two funniest uncles and podcasters.
I wonder if that's a double entendre.
Funny uncle, yeah. Do we think he knows what funny uncle means?
He might not.
Okay. This is from Guillermo.
Yes.
My last nephew. Name, Duralde.
Mm-hmm.
Over the last month or two, I have been binge listening to the last 2 years of podcasts.
Ouch.
As a result of Pilar, Duralde, his sister, our niece, and her obsession with talking my ears off with film jargon. I figured that I could learn a thing or two from the most knowledgeable people on the subject that I know. See, kid, you don't know enough people. Living in the house with your big brother, Alonzo.
My big brother.
Your big brother is Guillermo and Pilar's father.
Right. Yep. My brother, Fernando, who is, I should say, the person who set me on this path to begin with in a lot of ways. He's the one who came back from Harvard with all these books about Hollywood in the 40s and stuff that I devoured.
Living in the house with your big brother, Alonzo, I have been exposed to a number of movies that I would never have been exposed to otherwise, and some have been good, whereas others have been lousy. Well, Weed would be the judge of that, I think. I've heard so many people send in their top 10 lists, and I found several good movies I hadn't ever seen and been able to avoid several crap movies as a result. Anyway, I figured I would give my top 10 list a go in no particular order.
All right.
Here it is. Lord of the Rings. That kid is smart.
Oh, please. Go on.
The Godfather Parts 1 and 2.
Absolutely.
Training Day.
Oh.
Training Day is not good. No, Training Day is not good. He says Denzel Washington is a boss. That's true.
Well, sure, yes.
He is, but it's just not a good movie. You know who is good in that movie?
Oh, Macy Gray.
And Snoop.
Oh, yes.
Macy Gray and Snoop are great in Training Day. Everyone else is kind of annoying. Oh, God. How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Oh.
And you know which one he's talking about.
The live action.
Because that came out, what, 2001-ish, right? Something like that? Mm. Was it 2001?
We were living here.
Early 2000s.
Yeah.
And so that would have made Guillermo like 10 years old.
No, not even that.
Younger than 10.
Yeah, under 10. Yeah.
Younger than 10.
Wow, okay. So we'll
chalk that up to your childhood.
Sorry for the imprinting, but...
You know what? When I was a little kid, I liked Santa and the Three Bears.
Right. Yeah, no.
What a garbage movie that is. Fargo. So great. Fargo's great.
I've always found that movie overrated.
Capote.
Okay, yeah.
Die Hard.
Absolutely.
Animal House and the Blues Brothers, which are both fantastic.
Sure.
Bad Boys 1 and 2.
Oh, God.
And you know what? He's right about that. Because those are hilarious movies. God. And they make no sense, which makes them even better. all right, so what kind of knife? We're going to give you Grinch.
That was 10?
Yeah. We're going to give you the Grinch because...
You were young to know better.
Too young to know better. We're not giving you Training Day.
No, and I'm not giving you Lord of the Rings.
So you're 85% knife.
And I'm being generous by not bringing up Training Day in Fargo. Fine, whatever.
Honorable mentions.
Okay.
Cannonball Run and Smokey and the Bandit. And here's what he says, in parentheses, courtesy of Dave White. That's right.
And both shot in the Atlanta area.
Shawshank.
Ugh.
Yeah, it's not good. Fast Five, which is great.
Sure, yes.
The Avengers, which is great.
Yeah.
The Fugitive, which is great.
Sure, yeah.
White Christmas.
Okay.
And Star Wars 4 through 6, but in reality it's Star Wars 1 through 3.
Well.
The real Star Wars 1 through 3.
Yes.
Not those 4
Episode 4 through 6.
Yeah. Keep doing such great work and providing insight and laughs.
Oh, well, thanks.
All right, so we're done. Y'all, buy that Apple commentary.
It's $1.99.
You're going to love it.
PayPal us at Linoleum Podcast.
It will set your soul on fire. Fire!
LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com. You can PayPal us $1.99. We will send you the file. You can listen to it whenever you want, or you can listen to it as you're watching the movie. Either way, it is streaming on Netflix right now. We are going to be ordering t-shirts soon, I promise. And once that happens...
Look, everyone's just going to be patient with t-shirts. They cost money. We're going to get some And we're going to order t-shirts. And then you're going to buy them.
Yes.
And it's going to take place just like that in the order that we make it happen.
Also,
it's not like anyone's complaining anyway.
No, I know.
You've got this like burden on your head.
Because I know...
Like an anvil of something.
Well, because I think if once we spend money on getting them produced, we will make money selling
That's them. A great idea. We will do those things. Right. That's going to happen.
Okay.
Calm down.
Quit barking at me.
No listeners complaining. You are the one having a... Relax, Louise. I think that's a thing you say to me quite a bit.
I'm listening right now through my headphones, and I'm complaining. Yeah. As always, we ask you to check out our friends online. Go to ChristyLemire.com. If you have Sirius XM Radio, don't miss Rotten Tomatoes Radio with Matt Atchity and Gray Drake on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Tune in for the Frank DeCaro Show and Derek and Romaine. We were just on this week, and we always love giving Romaine the business. she's fun. Also, check out Fat Guys at the Movies, the Criterion Cast, Team Jack, the Schmoes Know, the B-Movies Podcast, Film Spotting SVU, Pod Crash, Game Night Guys, Secretly Timid, and The Lunch. Oh, we're going to be on The Lunch
next week.
We're
going to be on The Lunch this week, so talking about, be more of us.
Yeah, talking about RoboCops old and new. You can subscribe to the show for free on iTunes and leave us a review. That would be nifty. You can stream the show for free at Stitcher Radio or TheLounge.com or on our Facebook page, which is Linoleum Knife Podcast. Give us a like, and you can there's an app that you can click on to stream the show right there on Facebook while you're at work or whatever. Follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. You can follow Dave at D. Leland White, and I'm at A. Duralde, A-D-U-R-A-L-D-E. Check into the show on tvtag.com. And again, linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Any questions, comments, top 10 lists from your whole life or specific years or whatever you want to do, worst 10 lists. And email us for the Apple commentary. It's a lot of fun. And we will have our February commentary up, pretty soon.
By the end of February.
We're running out of February, so that'll be happening. Anyway, as always, we thank you for listening, and we will catch you next time.
Goodbye.